This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
She walked into our studio and said, what a difference a day makes. It is another day of big bank earnings. Citigroup, as we heard from Charlie, a blowout quarter, driven largely by that trading revenue. Also, Wells Fargo shares were up as the Fed's interest rate hikes, helping widen lending margins. We have a great person to round it all up for us.
Allison Williams is a senior global banks analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She joins us this afternoon from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Allison, let's start with Citi because it is the best performer on a percentage basis in the S&P 500, 14.5% today. What gives?
A solid quarter by Citi and positive operating leverage, which I think is something that investors have been wanting from Citigroup for years and years.
What's operating leverage? Talk to us about the significance of that.
Sure. So operating leverage is basically your revenue growth exceeds your expense growth, or, you know, if your revenue is pressured, that you can bring down costs, more than that. So you can have positive growth in profit. And so, reserves are another thing that we're watching, but that's sort of separate from the issue. This is really the core profitability. And if you think about the two bright spots,
so they're running
this quarter,
it really well, the business.
Correct. So revenue getting better and spending less to do that. And there's two macro things that are helping Citi. So they're one of the biggest in fixed income trading. Goldman is the other one in the U.S., by the way. And that
get ready
has
for
really
Monday,
gotten
maybe
a lift. And, and they're more focused on that business. They have their equities business is much smaller. So that really sort of lifts their overall trading a lot. And then net interest income, where estimates on Citi, I think, were relatively bearish versus the other companies. And obviously, that's a positive surprise for all the banks this quarter. And we do think that those two things continue to benefit Citi. You know, the issue with Citi has been on the cost side of things. But this quarter really showing a nice positive trend.
It's remarkable to see. I mean, we're talking the best day since in more than 2 years, since March of 2020. What were the big differences between the banks that reported today versus the banks that reported yesterday? As Carol said, when you came in, you said, what a difference a day makes.
So two things. One is, Citigroup has relatively more exposure to fixed income, and they did really well in that business. Wells Fargo has relatively more exposure to, fixed income?
Yeah.
And then Wells Fargo has more exposure to net interest income, and so they did better in that business. The other key thing this quarter is the buyback pause. So Citigroup, JP Morgan, and Bank of America all have hurdles going up following the Federal Reserve stress tests. Mm-hmm. JP Morgan said they're going to pause buybacks yesterday. Citigroup said the same thing today. But if you looked at where their capital ratio came in, there was a big upside surprise. So if their capital ratio coming in better means, yes, buybacks are paused, but perhaps they'll be able to kickstart those sooner. And again, it is, you know, it's about expectations and it's about valuations. JP Morgan really has had a premium valuation, premium profitability across the group, whereas Citigroup's story is more one improving profitability and is the lowest tangible book value, price to tangible book value multiple across the group. So some of it might be expectations. And then the final thing I'll say is now we have four banks, right? So yesterday We got some negatives. You don't know how widespread they're going to be.
Yeah.
And I would say the positive thing from the group, aside from the revenue trends I talked about, was the consumer is healthy. The consumer is borrowing. That's also helping Citigroup. And reserve building is there, but it's controlled. And so I'd say it's sort of Goldilocks in terms of what you'd expect. They did add some because the environment's uncertain, but nothing to get alarmed about.
Help me with the reserve building, because, I mean, they've got to do this, right? They are required by regulators, and this is kind of the offshoot, not kind of, right, coming off the financial crisis. So is it not an exact science, so that's why sometimes they have to do more? Like, tell me how this works.
So the change that happened, coincidentally, around the time that the pandemic took hold, was that banks have to look for the life of the loan.
Okay.
And so that adds a little bit more volatility to the number, right, than if you're just kind of, you know, marking to market every day. So they have to look at the life of the loan and the different economic scenarios and then estimate what losses will be. So even if things are excellent today, which they are, very strong, that was actually a positive surprise in terms of the current trends, banks have to say, you know, what is the probability of a recession next year? How severe that will that be? And so if that probability is increasing or that severity is increasing, you know, that it goes into the scenario and you would have a little bit of an increase.
So everybody's loan portfolio is a little bit different, right?
Everyone's portfolio is a little bit different and Okay. Everybody's economic assumptions could be a little bit different.
Okay. That makes sense.
What? I just want to talk about health of the consumer. And, you know, the comments we heard yesterday from the CEOs of J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley, they were pretty optimistic given what we were expecting and what I think a lot of people were sort of forecasting, to borrow from Jamie Dimon. How would you characterize what we heard from the CEOs today and executives just in the last minute that we have?
I would say confirming that the consumer is strong and healthy. Again, I think it's, you know, investors are worried about, you know, the later months, but, you know, time will tell on that front. The one thing with Citigroup where there's a little bit of a difference is the card borrowing side of things. And so seeing a little bit more of that. Bank of America will also give us a look on Monday. Keep in mind that they are a big lender to the U.S. consumers and companies.
Goldman, what's your expectations? Just got about 20.
Trading strong, but those equities marks are going to be brutal. Think about a year ago, huge fees, huge equity investment income, and that's going to reverse.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they have to say. Thank you so much. Perfect roundup. Allison Williams, Senior Global Banks Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us here in our Interactive Broker Studio. KBW Bank Index up almost 6%, was down 2% yesterday, but
as
she said,
that would be a good one to highlight at 3 o'clock.
Might I do that? Yes, I will. So get ready for a repeat. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic. Yes, it's Friday, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, data points, or at least some of them that we've been highlighting, looking forward to all week. We got some of them today. It has to do with U.S. long-term inflation expectations dropping to a one-year low. University of Michigan, five-year price forecast at 2.8%, with overall consumer sentiment boosted as gas prices fell.
As Carol mentioned earlier, you probably remember Wednesday we got 9.1% when it comes to the latest reading of CPI. That was a year-over-year figure. And our next columnist has a bone to pick with how it's measured. Justin Fox is columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Justin, why are we measuring inflation incorrectly?
I mean, I don't know that we're doing it incorrectly, but there are definitely different ways to do it, and you get a different view of it. With most monthly economic indicators, we talk about the change month to month, not how it compares with a year ago. And, you know, the reason we do it with inflation, we talk the 9.1% is how much higher prices were in June than 12 months before, is just that we think of inflation as an annual amount, and that's fine. You know, prices go up that much. But you can also just take the monthly change, which is also reported and gets talked about some, but doesn't get nearly as much attention because it's much smaller. It's 1.3% in June. You can take that and convert it into an annual number, which, you know, we do.
That's not pretty, though.
No, it's 17.1%.
It's really bad.
It's very volatile, and that may not be that meaningful, but you can take core inflation, which is less volatile, without food and energy, which a lot of policymakers watch, not because food and energy don't matter, but because it's more predictive of future inflation. And when you do that, what's kind of interesting, with the annual figures, it's 5.9% and falling over the last few months. If you do it with the monthly figures annualized, it's 8.8% and rising. So it's just, it's not like the only truth, but it's actually a useful way, especially when it's as volatile as it's been now, because inflation was sort of receding last fall, and then it's come roaring back thanks to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and some other things. And that, you know, you don't get that, all that nuance when you're just looking at the annual numbers.
So help me out here, because I feel like we got some fairly smart people at the Fed and a lot of smart economists floating around, and we've been, you know, analyzing data points for years. Why is it that we don't, as you make this point, maybe focus more on what you're talking about versus the year over year?
I'm sure that there are people in the Fed who focus more on the monthly inflation numbers and know in their head how to convert it to the annual. And it's actually, when the number's not that big, you can just multiply by 12.
Yeah.
The correct way involves taking it to the 12th power and whatever. Easy to do in Excel. So I don't think it's so much that the policy, the people who are deep into this at the Fed
right.
aren't totally aware of this. It's more that the discussion gets dominated by these somewhat out-of-date numbers. And right now, when I first was looking at this, it was like late last summer when the monthly numbers would have made things, annualized monthly numbers made things look much better. And I'm kind of glad I didn't write a column about it then because that would have been premature and kind of misleading.
Well, what does that tell you, though, that if you had done that then and it
I mean,
would have
it's
been
more
misleading?
Volatile. It's more volatile. And,
okay.
And, you know, and that can lead you astray. But I think it's pretty clear, like with GDP, if you look at what GDP would look like if you just took the annual change instead of the annualized quarterly change like we do, is you'd kind of always be a quarter or two late in noticing that there's a recession. And obviously we're looking at other indicators too. So again, the people who are really focused on this aren't missing it, but I think the discussion, the public discussion, misses out.
What about when it comes to measures of GDP?
Well, with GDP, if you do it right now, basically if you do the annualized, we're still growing. If you do the annual numbers comparing with a year
right.
ago, it's still positive. And if you do the quarterly numbers and you annualize them, you get minus 1 point whatever in the first quarter. And I haven't even looked yet what the GDP now was for today, but I assume it's something negative. And there are issues about what that exactly tells us, because GDP is affected by the net exports and the trade deficit in ways that are kind of counterintuitive. But it's still pretty clear that, you know, you could, if you're just using the annual numbers, sometimes you'll get a recession like in the early 2000s right. and it never shows up as negative GDP at all.
Interesting.
Just got about 30 seconds left here. So based on your column, your thinking, the Fed, do you think they're way behind? Just quickly.
I mean, the Fed are way behind. I don't think it's because they never look at monthly numbers. I think they were just still kind of concerned about digging out of the pandemic recession and just waited too long in retrospect.
But do you think they are, based on your own analysis, just quickly?
I mean, right now...
Meaning that should they be more aggressive? Because especially when we're going through 75 basis points, 100
basis
points, just quickly.
I don't know. I don't know the answer on whether they should be more aggressive now. I think at this point, it's pretty clear that they should have started earlier.
Yeah.
And maybe wouldn't have had to be so aggressive now.
Yeah, it's certainly been interesting. I love it. You gave us something to think about. Justin Fox, Bloomberg Opinion columnist. Check out his column at Bloomberg.com.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This week's Bloomberg Business Week cover story is the tale of a $500 billion mega project gone wrong. It began when Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman set out to build the city of Neom in an effort to revolutionize urban life.
Bloomberg News Saudi Arabia correspondent Vivian Nierheim and Businessweek editor Joel Weber help us understand this massive desert disaster.
Vivian basically was like, hey, how about we go big on Neom and try and learn everything we can? And you know, Neom, if you followed the story at all, has been a huge curiosity ever since MBS first announced it. But then it's been pretty opaque, and it's been really hard to get meaningful information about it. So this basically is the most thorough story anyone's ever published about the project. So Vivian, what is the project, and how far along is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, what is the project is a great question. And I think it's one that I went in thinking we might be able to answer. And then the sort of interesting thing was that even the people inside the project can't often answer that themselves. So it's become this sort of massive, sprawling ambition that keeps going in different directions. And that was kind of what was really interesting to discover it. And essentially, it's a new region now. It began its life as this idea to build a city from scratch. And now it's morphed into an entire semi-autonomous region full of different cities and different towns. And there's a tourism component to it. There's an industrial city that's going to, you know, float on the Red Sea, according to the plans. And there's even a ski resort up in the mountains, literally an outdoor ski resort in what is essentially the middle of the desert. So it is definitely going in some pretty unusual directions.
What is this area of Saudi Arabia like, and who lived there before MBS set out on this ambitious project?
Yes, I've been up to the area that they're calling Neom now maybe three times over the past few years. It is really remote. I mean, you basically have to, like, from Riyadh, the capital, you take like a 2-hour plane ride, and then you also drive for another 2 hours. So it's a place that most Saudis haven't been either. It's right on the border with Jordan, across the Red Sea from Egypt, very close to Israel, which is something a lot of people point out about this project. And it's very beautiful. Like, there's this gorgeous sort of like, you know, pristine beaches and these really dramatic mountains, but it wasn't super populated. There were, however, several towns along the coast where members of a tribe called the Choethat lived, and had been there for generations. So it wasn't an empty area, which is what sort of the Crown Prince and other people who promote Neom have promoted as, this sort of blank slate, right? There's no blank slate on Earth. And to invent the blank slate, they essentially began to remove those people who had lived there.
And so, you know, world events have happened since that announcement. There were initially a lot of investors, and then there was a killing of a prominent journalist. What happened to Neom's trajectory after that?
Yeah, well, so Jamal Khashoggi was an American resident. He worked for the Washington Post, which is obviously a major American publication, writing opinion columns. And his murder in 2018 was a huge shock to Saudi Arabia overall, to all of its projects and all of its plans. And definitely Neom took a huge knock. There was this huge advisory board that they had basically just announced that was like all these kind of high profile figures, all the way from sort of star architects like Norman Foster to, you know, ex-U.S. officials, Ernest Moniz, sort of the former U.S. Energy Secretary, and a lot of those people did actually pull out of the project after the murder came to light, essentially, and there was sort of a lot of pressure to back off of doing business with the Crown Prince, doing business with Saudi Arabia. The really interesting thing that I found as I started looking into this is that a lot of companies and architects and consultants are still doing business with Neom, sort of under, you know, not announced under the radar. You know, they're still doing plans, they're still doing projects, they're still working with them. And it's essentially almost the largest construction project in the world at this point. Like, it's become quite massive. You know, they have ambitions to have 450,000 laborers on the site within a couple years, which is basically the population of Miami.
Just the scale of it must be something to behold. And you actually have been out there before, right? And saw, you know, where it's all going to go down, or could go down, I guess. So tell us about that. And also, you know, if foreign money's not involved anymore, this is all being done how exactly?
That's a very good question. I think that's something they're still trying to figure out themselves. You know, I think the $500 billion number that they threw out there is like a starting budget. At this point, they still don't even know what a lot of this is going to cost. It could end up costing more. And where is that money going to come from? They still want it to come from outside. But right now, it's pretty much fully backed by the Public Investment Fund, which is Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. So they're spending, you know, they've already spent several billion on it. You know, they're spending pretty prolifically. I did go up there and sort of do a tour of the site officially. You know, I went to visit their main camp, which is this very sort of strange place in the desert surrounded by barbed wire, heavily secured, where they've got sort of hundreds and hundreds of, you know, high powered executives and professionals from all over the world who are working, you know, on this camp essentially, which is like very much felt like a cross between like something from Silicon Valley and like maybe like a minimum security prison, you know? And even the employees make a lot of jokes about that. They're like, oh, you know, the wall, we're not sure if it's to keep people out or to keep us in. So it's a very strange atmosphere. There's not a ton of sort of like visible construction going on now. It's a lot of preparatory work. It's like groundwork, you know, they're digging big tunnels, they're smoothing out ground, but it's not like you can go there now and like see a city or see, you know, any of the things that they've been planning. There's still a pretty big gap between what they're talking about and what's happening on the ground.
Vivian, it sounds like they start things, they start working on it, then they back off of it. It sounds like a lot of, you know, starts and stops. Who does seem to be winning, though, all in, is if you're a consultant or anybody involved in the project. I love the line you talk about, two buckets for those who work on the project. And one of it is a bucket just to hold all the money that they're making.
Don't mention the other bucket, Carol.
I won't mention the other bucket. Well, you can.
For number twos.
But people are making a ton of money off of this.
Yes. Yeah, there are a lot of people who have found this to be an incredibly lucrative project, and that is predominantly the consultants and the people who come from outside to work there, which was something that sort of came up again and again in my conversations with people, was that this is basically like a life-changing job for a lot of people. Like, they can come and make so much money that they can essentially, you know, it makes a huge difference for their life. They can finish putting their kid through college. They can, you know, save up for a retirement home. And so many of the people who come to do that are basically coming to earn that giant paycheck, and they don't all necessarily actually have an investment in what actually happens once they're gone.
All right, of course, that was the Bloomberg Business Week cover story, a fantastic cover story, and that was Bloomberg News Saudi Arabia correspondent Vivian Nirime, along with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber. And be sure to catch our Bloomberg Business Week radio broadcast and podcast, our broadcast. You can catch it on Bloomberg Radio at 8 a.m. Our podcast, you can just download it today on your way home.
Yeah. Hey, today. Another shout out for this cover story of Bloomberg Business
incredible.
Week. I've got the issue in my hand right here. What does $500 billion build in the Saudi desert? A royal fantasy brought to you by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Some really great reporting, just some fantastic images in there as well.
Yeah. Our weekend show and podcast also including an AI startup that's helping to figure out COVID variants. We also talk about the economic inflationary picture and oil prices. Get ready probably for them to still stay high for not maybe months, maybe even years. So there's a lot. And also we do a deep dive into retail. And we also talk about some cool EV motorcycles, don't we?
A lot of cool stuff in the weekend show.
Yeah, really good stuff. So check it out. Download it or catch it on radio at 8 a.m. on Saturday. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So on the Bloomberg today from our Bloomberg Law team, it's a story about how the bursting of the cryptocurrency market is fueling calls for clearer guidelines on how to treat assets in crypto company bankruptcies.
Some numbers that have been thrown around over the last few months have included the destruction of $2 trillion in the decline of crypto from a market that was $3 trillion down to about $1 trillion right now. Let's get into it, Carol, with Steve Russell, portfolio manager and senior research analyst at Emerald Advisors. Steve is the co-portfolio manager of the Emerald Finance and Banking Innovation Fund. Steve, good to have you with us. How are you?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Well, thanks for joining us. You know, I really want to focus our conversation this afternoon around the technology underlying cryptocurrency, because we do talk a lot about daily price moves. But, you know, we talk to people like you, and I know this thanks to some notes that you sent to our producer, Paul Brennan, earlier. You think that a lot of people are ignoring the power of the underlying technology. And we do hear this from a lot of people, that this is very similar to the early days of the internet. So prove it to us that this underlying technology is here to stay.
Sure. Thanks, Tim. So, you know, we're really interested in investing in the software, which is what we, you know, distributed ledger technology. We look at it. It's just software. People talk about blockchain. There's different types of blockchains. And we're seeing a lot of implementation and adoption by large companies. You know, if you look at some of the larger companies here in the United States, they utilize different types of blockchain already in their operations, everything from Anthem. You know, if you look overseas, Allianz is actually utilizing, and it's across different industries, so it's not just in the financial services world. You know, you look at Walmart, for instance. They use it for payment processing. They use it for inventory tracking. You see Boeing using blockchain to actually kind of track their repairs on their airplanes. So there's a lot of applications that we think will continue to adopt blockchain and across multiple industries. So we're trying to invest in companies that are actually improving their business plans utilizing the technology. It's kind of like when you look back at the internet, right?
Right. Well, Steve, go back here for, because I do feel like we're kind of relearning the crypto world all over again, because I do feel like when this started to all come out, I found blockchain kind of really interesting in terms of how it could secure things, move things around. How should we think about blockchain today? Like what it is, what it actually is, and what it's replacing?
Yeah, so blockchain is just software, and it's software that allows for trusted transactions to occur frictionless without an individual needing to spur that transaction. So it's kind of like an if-then statement. If my inventory reaches this dock, once it gets scanned, then payment is digitally made without any, it could be 24/7, 365. No one actually has to spur that payment. It just occurs because of a smart contract that's sitting, you know, that's embedded in the software.
So is it just like programs that are already just kind of set up? It's almost like a macro, like this happens, so then this should happen?
Well, and that's basically it. So you have it's, you know, the blockchain transaction, it's a trusted transaction that you don't need to have someone verify. And then because it's software, you can implement all kinds of other activities that take place once something else has taken place. So that's exactly it.
Well, can you give us some real-world examples? Because like Carol said, I got really interested in this years ago, and we
right?
started to hear a lot about IBM and companies like that actually harnessing blockchain technology. But what I failed to see materialize is specific examples of how this tech has actually made our life better. Like, you
right.
know, when you go to buy an apartment, for example, it's supposed to be easier if you use, you know, have your deed on the blockchain, right? But that's not happening right now.
So we haven't seen that yet. A lot of that information needs to be put onto the blockchain. But we have seen, you know, and you mentioned IBM. IBM does a lot of implementations of a blockchain called Hyperledger. There's a lot of large companies that are adopting that. But in the banking space, you know, we see a lot of adoption that is starting to occur in the mortgage space. So Figure Technologies is a company that's working, focused on the mortgage side. They're actually taking mortgage information, putting it on the blockchain, and then taking that information and using it for securitizations. When they first started doing this, every mortgage that had to be put into those securitizations had to be audited. It cost anywhere from $200 to $500 per mortgage for those audits. And now, you know, the government, when they first started doing it, said, oh, you still have to do the audits. We don't believe that, you know, you can follow this information on the blockchain. But now the government's come back and said, oh, we get it. That information is on the blockchain. You don't have to audit each mortgage that's going in there. And so we see Figure working with multiple banks, really putting that information on blockchains and doing securitizations.
Hey, just got about a minute left, Steve. So I'm looking at your Emerald Finance and Banking Innovation Fund. It's down about 50% so far year to date. A lot of the holdings are banks, certainly familiar to our Bloomberg audience, Bancorp, Signature Bank, Customers Bancorp. So all of these, are they playing already in the blockchain space?
So not all of them, but quite a few of the names in there, obviously you mentioned a few, are involved in the space. They're utilizing it for payments. Tacit is a company that's working with a lot of these banks. They're doing real-time payments with these banks, and their customers are demanding it. We had a small bank customers up in Reading, Pennsylvania, that implemented this technology, and they brought in $2 billion in zero-cost deposits in less than a month from their existing customers that wanted to use this payment system.
Why aren't the big banks, like here we are, we're talking about JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, excuse me, today. Where are the big banks on this? And just got about 20 seconds.
Yeah, so JP Morgan's, you know, despite what we hear from Jamie Dimon at times, they are very much involved in this space. They have their Onyx division. They had their JP Morgan coin that they've been utilizing since 2017. So, you know, they are on the forefront of this technology as well. I just don't think you see a lot of announcements about it.
All right, we got to run. Steve Russell over at Emerald Advisors, thank you so much. Crossing the Bloomberg Terminal.
Yeah, Facebook parent Meta, Amazon set to pull back on NYC office expansions.
That's a big deal. You're listening to Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.